So, more questions today. Here we get in it. Get into it straight away. Question number one. Should a stream entrant die and be reborn in the human realm of another religion, does he leave the mother religion and seek for the Dharma? And would be born with a typical characteristic of a stream? Thank you. Yeah, sure they would. So no matter what religion they were born into, they would actually seek out the Dharma, because that was their natural inclination. They would actually just be leaning towards Dhamma, even if they were born in a religion or in a house where there was alcoholics or bad parents, their nature will be good. So it doesn't really matter what their parents are doing, even if their parents are maybe having a wrong livelihood, like being a hunter or a fisherman, the stream enter would just incline to being a good person, just their nature. Their mind is so pure that no matter what situation they're in, they'd always make something beautiful and wonderful about it. How the stream enter. Dhirajan, some monks and nuns preach the importance of not touching a dead person for 8 hours to avoid disturbing the stream of consciousness and thereby preparing the being into a woeful state. Wouldn't this type of teaching condition people negatively into irrational fears, clinging and delusion? Ajahn, please comment. Yes, I agree. It does condition people negatively into irrational fears, clinging and delusion. It's not true. Once a person is dead, they can't feel their body. In the same way that once you get into a deep meditation, you know, you've had the experience in deep meditation, you can't feel the flies on your body. You can't feel any aches and pains. You can't hear the bell. You can't feel the hot and the cold. When you get into a deep state of meditation, the senses sort of disappear, the 5 senses. So the point is, once a person is dead, they can't feel the body anymore. In fact, it's usually a minute or two before they die. Because as everybody who's seen a person die knows, that dying is not a sudden moment. 1 minute they're alive and pop, they're gone. It's a transition. And 1 minute they're alive, there's a whole process of dying and things switching off. And after about, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes, maybe a bit longer, a bit shorter. And afterwards, you know, yeah, they're dead. But in that time, when they started the dying process, to the time they finish, you can't point to any one particular time and say, ah, that's the point they're dead, physically. However, if you have any sort of psychic powers, you may be able to see the stream of consciousness leaving the body and say, ah, that's the point they're dead. The point is, by the time they're dead, they cannot feel their body at all. So you can do whatever you like to it. In particular, that you should be an organ donor. So, if out of compassion and kindness, out of charity, if you can't give anything else in your life, at least when you're dead, you can say that at the last, because they have to actually harvest the organs just before you die. Because if they get it just after you die, the organs are just can't be used, or most of them can't be used. Some can, I think skin can still be used, your eyes can be used, but some of the internal organs, they just usually harvest it just a minute or two before you fully die, dead. And at that time you can't feel a thing. So you don't have to worry about people touching you, and in fact it's wonderful to touch you even at the time of death. If you're a touchy-feely person, and you like sort of, you know, maybe your loved ones around you holding your hand or touching you, is a marvelous way to die. It doesn't propel you into lower realms. The mind is the most important. If you have this beautiful feeling of warmth and compassion at the end from your loved ones holding your hands as you sort of make that transition into death, sometimes you're so happy, so at peace, so still. It doesn't matter about the body. The mind is important. You just go off to a beautiful heavenly realm. The same way that if you're going to give your organs when you die, you can sign all those forms. I'm an organ donor myself. I carry the card around with me. I didn't bring it into this room here. It's just in here. It's in my room over there. So if ever I die, you can have whatever you want of me. And you can touch me straight away. Once I'm dead, even girls can touch me. It doesn't matter. Once I'm dead, not before, thank you. What that means is you can take anything, because once you're dead you don't feel the body anymore. The body's done its job, you can leave it alone. So make that special point, you can touch the body after death. You can sort of harvest the organs. It's a great thing to be able to do. Imagine what happens if after you're dead, or as you're sort of dying, you know you've only got a minute or two left of this life, and you sort of make that wonderful gift of a life to many people. We've got many organs, so we can just give so much to other people. I don't know if you've ever been to dialysis centres, see people who have to be on that machine three times a week for the rest of their lives. They're just waiting for somebody with a healthy kidney to donate one. You've got two of them. And if you're deaf, you can actually donate your kidneys. Imagine that good karma you're making. And some people say, if I donate my kidneys, I'll have no kidneys left when you get to heaven. Remember, whatever you get, so many times back, you probably have six or seven kidneys in you when you get to heaven. You'd just be so full of kidneys and full of, you give your heart, so a couple of hearts, three or four hearts in there. You give your eyes, you get these amazing eyes all over the place. The point, whatever you give to others, you always get back in return. So it's a marvellous thing to do, to be an organ donor. And most Buddhists actually are. So you can touch the body of the death. Our most honourable teacher, thank you for opening the door of the deathless to us and show us what happens, what happiness truly is. Given your care to us, even though Ajahn was sick for 9 days, it's only the first couple of days, we'll keep the seed of contempt that Ajahn gave us and grow it in our, until it blossoms in our heart. May Ajahn have all the happiness and good health always, smart and contented. That's very good. Fan mail. I like fan mail. It's very good that, but I will never always be truly in good health. It's the nature of all bodies to sometimes be sick. But as the Buddha kept on saying, even though the body is sick, the mind doesn't need to be sick. It doesn't matter how sick you feel, don't allow it to overpower you. Keep a happy mind. Then the mind can always have fun with the sicknesses. Dear Ajahn, why did the Buddha make it a parajika offense, that's a disrobing offense, when an enlightened monk tells another he's enlightened, kindly advice? It's only if they are lying that they're enlightened. In other words, if somebody comes along just to impress other people, they say, yeah, I'm enlightened, when they know they're not. If they're actually telling the truth, it's called a paticca, it's a lesser offense, but it still is not to be done. And for many people, they are concerned, why can't, like monks or nuns, tell other people about their attainments? And again, the answer I think I gave a few days ago was that the Buddha really wanted to have like an equality in the Sangha, groups of monks and nuns. So otherwise you think, he's enlightened, he over there isn't. And the example which I usually give was of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, which everyone thought he was enlightened, and I agree probably was. He was. But you may know that it's much a better good karma if you give to an enlightened person than if you give to one who's not enlightened. You get more merit back. So for example, if you give a banana to an ordinary monk, you get so much good karma. But if you give a banana to an enlightened monk, that's huge good karma. So that everybody knew this in Thailand. So one day, I already mentioned yesterday, last night, the type of food we had. One day, in Ajahn Chah's monastery, this car pulled up, and in the back you had heaps of this delicious food. Pots and pots of it. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, I can get a good meal today. And the driver came out of the car, and his first question was, is Ajahn Chah in the monastery today? And so he said, no, he's outside. So the man got in his car and drove away. that hurt. Because he thought, it's a waste of time giving my delicious, expensive food to these guys. They're just ordinary monks. He'd only want to give it to Ajahn Chah. You can see why keep it quiet. So you look at all monks as being the same. And it's true even in the time of the Buddha that sometimes there's some of these monks are little novices, and sometimes the people wouldn't realize that some of these little novices were great arahats, fully enlightened with psychic powers. And there's one of them, Sumana novice. Actually, we've got a monk, a novice called Sumana. He's one from the Buddhist Fellowship from Singapore. we ordained this training in my monastery. This was Simon, a novice years ago, and he was only a sort of a small novice, but he was fully enlightened, had an enormous psychic powers. He'd just done this incredible psychic battle with a Naga. A Naga is one of these dragons which lives up in the Himalayas, a very fierce one. And the Buddha, knowing his power, sent him to do battle with this Naga, actually to get some water from this lake. And the Naga protected that lake jealously. So when this novice tried to get some water, the Naga tried to stop him, and they had this psychic battle. And the novice, he's only 7 or 8 years of old, just beat this Naga. And the Naga ended up paying worship to him and giving him the water. And then the novice, he levitated all the way to the Himalayas, levitated all the way back again, and gave the water to the Buddha. And the Buddha was the Buddha was testing him to see how strong he was. And then the next day, an arms round, he's only a tiny little novice, and some of the monks would pull his ears and tell him to walk faster. And this little novice, he wouldn't react at all. And as soon as the Buddha saw this, these monks were tweaking his ears and knocking him on the head. He said, "Come over here, monks." He said, "You don't know what you've been playing with. Yeah, it may just look like a little novice, but this is just what he did yesterday." And they told the monks about this great battle he had with this dragon. And the monks were just, "Oh, that little novice could have actually battled us. No, we're much weaker than a dragon, a Naga." But the novice never wanted to let on that he was fully enlightened with his psychic powers. And after that, the Buddha actually gave this wonderful story about, I think there were 3 or 4 things, the young things, you'd always be very careful of. You'd always be careful of four things. A young fire, because a fire which is only a small fire in the bush can very easily become a big, huge bushfire. A little fire in the house could actually burn down your house. So you should be careful of it when it's very small. Don't think that's only a small fire, it doesn't matter. It could soon burn into a big fire. You'd also be very careful of small snakes. They may be baby snakes, but they still have enough venom to kill you. And the third thing, you should be wary of baby princes. They may be only small little fellows, but one day they'll become kings. And then they'll remember what you did to them, and they'll get their own back. So you'd be very careful of baby princes. And the last thing you should be afraid of or careful of is baby monks. They may look like little monks or little nuns, but they may have great psychic powers, more than you know of. So be careful. And sometimes you don't know some of these little fellows what they've been doing and how powerful they can be. So because of that every monk, every nun gets treated equally, because you don't know which ones are enlightened and which ones aren't. It's very hard sometimes for you to tell. Sometimes these monks and nuns are just so quiet, they're so peaceful, you think they're lazy. But they've actually done a lot. So that's why the Buddha said, "Don't let anybody know about your attainments." And he said, "What you can do, you can tell your fellow monks." So, like monks, we tell each other what we're up to. We never sort of actually pronounce that to lay people. So if you really want to know what a monk is doing, you don't have to ask him directly. Ask one of his friends. I should be telling you that, but that's actually the trick. So if you've got a monk there and you want to find out, "I wonder where that monk's at," you never ask him directly. You ask one of his close companions, "Hey, what is that monk? What do you reckon of him?" And you get a much better idea. And it's also that sometimes some monks by pride. Sometimes they want to impress their disciples, and so they start making all these claims which turn out to be untrue. You can imagine how disappointing that would be. And if you had a teacher who said there were this, there were that, and you found out afterwards they weren't. It's so disappointing. So instead of that, we don't have in Buddhism a guru tradition. It's not the teacher, it's the teachings which are important. So we don't worship a teacher. We worship the teachings. It doesn't matter who gives the talks. It doesn't matter whether a monk or whether a nun. What matters is what comes out of the mouth and the Dhamma, whether it really is to the point or not. So it becomes selfless Dhamma. That's why the monks don't actually say they're enlightened or they're not enlightened, because that's more like ego. And here we're supposed to be getting rid of all of that. from having thought of non-self. That's just Dhamma, that's all. So that's one of the reasons, and it's a moralistic offence because the Buddha really wanted to stamp that out of monks or nuns claiming to be what they're not. It's also the psychic powers as well, because this is why the monks don't show their psychic powers. The original story behind the Buddha prohibiting monks demonstrating their psychic powers was when in the town of Rajgir, there's one of the lay people, just like you, they thought, now, all these monks and nuns of all the different sects around at the time, they always say they can levitate, but I've never seen anybody levitating. They said, let's just find out whether these monks and nuns are just making this up or whether it's the truth. So, now, what do actually monks need? One thing they do always need is like a bowl, an alms bowl. So he got this very expensive sandalwood bowl carved up by a carpenter. And he made this like trellis of bamboo poles. And he put the bowl right at the top. It's like impossible to climb up that trellis without bringing the whole thing down. It was too unstable. But he said, if there is any monk, nun, ascetic, or whatever, who can levitate, let them levitate and take that bowl. And if they can reach that bowl through levitation, they can have it. So it's almost like a contest. And it was actually proclaimed throughout the whole city. If anyone can do this, let them take the bowl. If they can't, that bowl is going to stay up there. That will prove they can't do it. And so, one day these two monks, it was Kalindawacha and Mahamoggallana, they were walking together on arms round, and they saw that bowl, they started thinking about what the contest was. And Kalindawacha said, Mahamoggallana, you've got great powers, you go and take the bowl, just to give faith to everybody. And he said, no, you take it. You know, you've also got psychic powers. And Kalindawacha said, okay. So he went, rose up into the air, and he took the bowl. Now his mistake was, instead of just taking the bowl and going down again, his mistake, he decided to fly around Rajagaha. It was literally three laps of honour, around Rajagaha three times, with the bowl, so everyone could see him. Imagine what that happened around Ipoh. Say if this afternoon I levitated and went all around Ipoh three times, you had the whole city coming in here. And that's what happened there. When he got back, everybody in Rajagaha saw this little watcher, going flying through the air three times with this bowl. And they all came just to, to ask him questions, to worship him, to make merit, to ask him to chant for their Sikh relations, everything. So this whole crowd of people came into the Bamboo Grove Monastery where he was staying. And the Buddha said, what are all these people coming here for? And that's where the Buddha found out that this Kalindawacha had risen up to this bowl. And the Buddha really scolded him. And he said, what you've done, Kalindawacha, you've exhibited a psychic power for this stupid wooden bowl. And please excuse me, but this is what the Buddha said. He said, you're like a prostitute who shows her private parts just for a few coins. And so that's what you've done. These things are supposed to be private, your psychic powers. And you've actually almost like sold them for just a stupid bowl, for material things. Never do that again. And he really scolded him. Because that's what happens, that sometimes if you exhibit a psychic power, people come and see you just to see your powers. Please give us a show. And they don't come to listen to Dhamma. They forget that they think psychic powers is all there is. So that's why the Buddha said, no psychic powers. That's why we don't have... don't say about being enlightened or not either. Find out when we die. Dear Ajahn, can an arahat remain as a layperson? I was told that he has to renounce and become a monk, otherwise he will die in 7 days. Is an arahat's wisdom and compassion the same as a Buddha's? Okay. Now I should warn you about this. This is your last day and all the energies are coming up. All the power of about 7 or 8 days of meditation. It all does build up that way, strengthening and strengthening all the powers of letting go. And who knows, this might be your day. But if you get fully enlightened, unfortunately, you'll have to join the Sangha. Whether you like it or not, you can't go back to your husband, to your wife. You won't be able to go back to your job or your TV. You won't be able to see the soccer or the movies anymore. I'm terribly sorry, But that's just the way things are. Because it's true, the arahat, if you're a lay person, become an arahat. If you can understand what I was talking about the last couple of days, and especially you will, there's nothing to keep you going anymore. The will, which is important to actually to be, to exist, for your life faculty to continue. If you become an arahat, fully enlightened, that's all just vanishes. You're so peaceful and still that there's no reason, there's no force to keep the life faculty going. Unless you join the Sangha, and as a Sangha you become like a field of merit, so people can give food to you, give robes, give whatever, and you accept them, knowing that by so accepting, it's not you that you need them, people make huge good karma with you. And number two, you have the opportunity to live the life by example, to be this beautiful, peaceful person in robes, like a true son and daughter of the Buddha, and maybe even to teach, and thereby that is the purpose of your life, to give a field of merit to other beings, to be an example and to teach. And that is what motivates your life as an arahat. It keeps you going in the Sangha. All the other usual ways which keep you alive are taken away. I think you should all know that the will to live is crucial to the continuance of your life. Even now, you don't even need to commit suicide. If you really say, I'll give up the will to live, you will deteriorate and soon you will die. That will to live, the life faculty, is as crucial as good health. So that's why a person who becomes an arahat, a layperson, they will pass away very quickly. Or else they have to join the monkhood or the nunhood. Do you understand? Great question, but that's what happens. Dear Ajahn, are there such things called wholesome wishes in the meditation towards emptiness, since any wishes are wantings? Why is it that it is good to have good wishes in normal day practice, but not during the meditation practice? How do these two attitudes relate to each other as a whole in the real essence of practice? Okay, we start with our good wishes, wishing people well, but we don't really know what wellness is. There's a trouble with metta, that sometimes we think we're doing good, and we really, our heart is in the right place, we have no wisdom though. The old story which I often tell is about the Boy Scout. And the Boy Scout, if you ever remember the Boy Scouts, they're not so many these days, but they used to have to do one good deed a day. That was like the creed. To do your good deed for the day. So one day this Boy Scout saw this old woman by the side of the road, and he helped her across the road through the traffic, and that was his good deed for the day. The only problem was the old woman didn't want to go, but she was too embarrassed to tell him. So often when we help people, we think we're doing a wonderful thing, but the other person, they don't want that, thank you. They don't want to be helped across the road. So sometimes if we have wisdom without, sorry, compassion without wisdom, sometimes it doesn't work. So good wishes, what are you wishing somebody? Is it really good for them? Sometimes you wish me long life. Oh, please, come on, be kind. Isn't it being selfish? And sometimes, you know, somebody's in hospital, oh, I hope you get better. And they're about to die, they've had enough, and you're going to wish them better. So sometimes our wishes are all wrong. Sometimes you may wish to win the lottery and become really wealthy. Some people ask me that. Sometimes, or they do a good karma, they offer a robe or some food. You see them in front of the Buddha statue. May I have six numbers, please? May I have six numbers? That's the Australian lottery. So it's crazy that, you know, they wish for something, but what they're wishing for is a whole heap of suffering. You only have to read articles in the newspaper of people who do win the lottery, and just about every one of them has a lot of suffering. I should have cut this out of the newspaper, but about 6 months ago there was an article about this fellow in the United States. At that time, I think it's still probably the case, he had the record, the biggest lottery win in history. It was something like $700,000 or $800,000 US dollars. This huge lottery win. In the United States, you have to pay tax on these lottery wins. So with the IRS, the tax office in the United States, he negotiated a deal. He'd get $111 million, and that was his winnings. Now, if you had $111 million, would you be happy? He was very happy before he got that money, and afterwards he went crazy. And the article in the newspaper was him going to jail. He'd been arrested, convicted of a stupid crime, and now he was going to spend the rest of his life in jail. And they said before, he was just such a wonderful, happy-go-lucky person. He didn't have much, he had his friends, you know, he had his life, but now he had prison. It's one of the cases there, maybe an extreme case, but an average case in many other respects. But what happens when you get unexpected wealth like that? Drives you crazy. So sometimes we have this wish, may I win $111 million, but you're wishing for something which is going to hurt you. So wholesome wishes have to be wise wishes, which is sometimes the best wish, is I wish you peace of mind, happiness, freedom, contentment. I don't want you to be wealthy, I want you to be content and happy. So that's my wish for you, because I know what's wise and what's not wise. So when sometimes people say, I'm sure you can know the lottery numbers, please tell me the name of the next horse which is going to win in the horse racing, because I really need the money. And they tell me, so once I get the horse, you give me the horse number and I win, I'll give the monastery 10%, I'll give you, you know, your retreat centre. I say, only 10%, that's unfair, I do all the work and you get my well, I'd never do that. Because the point is, it's not really a wholesome wish. So give them wholesome wishes. In other words, that may you be peace and happy. Be free of all this craving and all this desire. Be content with what you've got. So that's a wholesome wish. That's really a good wish. And that's when you understand what meditation is, when you understand what life is, the two come together. You really wish a person, not richness, not even beauty, because you know some ladies, sometimes it's beautiful ladies and they wish, my goodness, I wish I hadn't been born so beautiful. Everybody just looks at my body, they never look at me. And sometimes that, you know, that's all they think about, and that's all that other people think about, and they have a terrible life. So it's much better to be born average. Not too wealthy, not too poor. Not too beautiful, not too ugly. Just in the middle is the right way. Middle way. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it always the same process to seeing nimittas? Thank you. Yeah, it's always the same process in the sense that you just let go of the five senses and you build up energy of the mind. And that's the way the nimittas arise. When the five senses get weaker and weaker, the mind energy gets bigger and bigger, that's when you see the nimittas. Why was there a need to organize a meeting council for all the various Buddhist traditions? Was there disharmony or confusion among the devotees and teachers? What was achieved or established in the meeting of the council? I think a lot of disharmony happens when people don't talk to each other, when they don't meet together, because when there's no meeting, there's no talk, there's lots of misunderstandings, and it's the misunderstandings cause a disharmony and a bad feeling. So that's why the Buddha said just before he passed away, the monks, you should have regular meetings together, to come together in harmony, to discuss the matters which are necessary, and to depart in harmony together. If you have any meeting, never leave when there's disharmony. Keep on going. You may have disagreements, but then remember, your friendship is most important. I make that a very important part of, you know, our Buddhist society in Perth. I say, look, it's a Buddhist is the first word before society. So it's Buddhist first. Got it? Buddhist. We're Buddhists. We're here for Buddhism. So that way that the Buddhist principles are paramount. You know, like forgiveness, compassion, just silence, listening, letting go, giving up, not getting your own way, but seeing how much you can give up, how much you can serve, not what you can get out of this. And when you keep those Buddhist principles sort of in any committee meeting, in any meeting, it just goes so smoothly. Because now people remember, they don't have, not supposed to have egos, so they don't express their egos. They're more easy to forgive and to have fun. So our committee meetings are good fun. We've got a lot of jokes, and there's never any arguments. You know, we can actually discuss and have different points of view. We say, look, we're Buddhists. Okay, that, you know, six people have this view, four people have another view. If I'm one of the four, I'm going to give in to the other six for the sake of harmony, because harmony is more important than being right. Rather than getting the best outcome in terms of finances or buildings, the best outcome is concerning people. You may have the most beautiful monastery and buildings, but if our committee and our members are always fighting, that's a bad sign we don't give priority to the right things. I'd rather have ugly buildings and harmonious community than beautiful buildings and ugly community. The people are most important. That's Buddhism. So because traditionally and under history, all our Buddhist traditions and sects have actually been dispersed to different corners of the globe. You know, Vajrayana was off in Tibet and Mongolia, and Mahayana was there in China and Taiwan. Zen was over in Japan. Theravada was locked into Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Burma, Sri Lanka, and they never met for centuries. And now this is this wonderful age when in most cities you can find Theravada monks, Tibetan monks, Zen monks, Chinese monks, and nuns as well. We're all living next to each other. Look at me today. I'm giving a talk here in a Mahayana Chinese temple. It's a sign of our times. So we do come together, so we start talking together. When we start talking together, all this business of you guys are the small vehicle and we're the real vehicle, we're the fast vehicle, this is the higher Buddhism, you're the lower Buddhism, all of that sort of stuff just disappears. When we find out we're all disciples of the Buddha. There's no such thing as, yeah, the monks, they're superior than the nuns. All that superior business just disappears when we meet together. And you find, hey, that might be a Mahayana nun, but she's doing what I'm doing. She's, now, I don't know why she's, what sutra she's reading, but her practice is exactly the same as my practice. And then you get this incredible respect for each other. And with that respect, you get harmony, you get working together. And then it means the Sangha, the leaders of the Buddhist communities, that we're showing by example what harmony is. We may be wearing different robes, coming from different traditions, maybe different genders, but we can work together for the common cause of Dhamma. We show by example that you may be married to a husband who's a Christian and you're a Buddhist, but you can work together without needing to convert each other for the common cause of your family, for your society, for your country, for your world. What a wonderful sign that is for our modern age. We can have harmony without changing the colour of our robes, without our religion, without sort of changing our race, without changing anything. That's why we had a meeting. Because I felt, certainly I was one of the main instigators, or the instigator of this meeting in Sydney with all the Australian Buddhist traditions, or all the Buddhist traditions in Australia, because I was embarrassed there could be any ill feeling at all between us. I didn't have ill feeling, but if I heard that anybody else had ill feeling towards, say, Theravada, I wanted to stop that, so that we could have harmony, so we could show by example that we're following the Buddha's example. That's why we had this meeting. Okay? Why did the Buddha and other Arahats continue to meditate even after their enlightenment? Actually, what's the question should be, why did they continue to work after their enlightenment? Because meditation is a natural state. When you let go, you don't do anything, that's what happens. You just go into deep stillness and jhanas. So you actually have to do something, actually to teach and to help other people. So the question would really be, why did the Buddha and other Arahats not meditate so often? Why did they go out and teach? And that's because of compassion and kindness for others. So meditation is a not doing. So when you relax and let go, you rest as an Arahat, as a Buddha, you just go into deep meditation. Naturally. That's your ground state. Is that okay? If when I'm answering these questions, there's something you don't agree with, put your hand up and interrupt. Hope you don't mind to explain the practicing of the four applications of mindfulness, contemplation of the body, feeling, mind, and mind objects in this meditation retreat. I've been doing this all during this retreat because the four Satipatthanas, said the Buddha, and that's the four, the contemplation, the application of mindfulness, that is fulfilled and completed, said the Buddha, by practicing Anapanasati. If you've been doing Anapanasati, you'll be fulfilling the four applications of mindfulness to its completion, to the max. When you watch the breath, and it's a physical feeling, then you're watching the body. When you watch the, when the breath disappears and it becomes a feeling, that the beautiful breath, you're watching Vedanas. When you get the nimitta coming up or jhanas, you're watching the citta, the mind, the third application of mindfulness, which is always the most difficult. Many people think that they can just understand the mind when the five senses are still there. You can't. The only way you can do that third application of mindfulness, to be aware of the citta, is only in the nimitta stage or in the jhanas. And lastly, the mind objects, you do that afterwards when you see the impermanence fading away, cessation, abandoning of all these things, like the frog who has left the lake, sees the impermanence fading away, disappearance of these things. So these are the four foundations of mindfulness, or the four applications of mindfulness. The reason you do these four applications of mindfulness is this. You have to understand the purpose of this. Why are you doing this? And the purpose of the four applications of mindfulness is to see the emptiness of a self. Because the Buddha recognized that these four things are where a person assumes they exist. These are the four places where a sense of self is. The first one, on the body, still many people associate themselves with the body. They identify with the body. They think they are the body. Sometimes people identify with their feelings. They identify with the happiness. So they get really overwhelmed by the happiness. Or sometimes you get identified with the pain. And so you think you are the pain. You've got no separation there between, sort of a knower and the pain. You identify with it so much that you really suffer. It's just pain, that's all. Don't make a self, a me out of it. Now the next two are the big places where people identify a self. The citta, that's especially the knower. That which can know and see and hear and feel. I mentioned that one, I think, a couple of nights ago. When we identify with being the one who knows or that which knows, then that becomes one of the places where we assume that we exist. There is a self, a soul. And that's a delusion. So you contemplate that until it disappears. And the mind objects, the sankharas, one of the biggest of the sankharas, told by the Buddha, is the will. To the point that, again, in the Chinese Agamas, the translation for sankhara in that context was, I think, Venerable Sumana, Wai Lun, pointed this out to me. He was reading the Agamas in Chinese, and he noticed that the word for sankhara was the same as the word for will, doing. So the fourth of the Satipatthanas also includes, as one of its major parts, the will. Because that's the other place where you can very easily assume a self. I am the one who does. So by focusing on these things, you're seeing where your illusion of a self is born. You think you are your body, you think you are your feelings, you think you're the knower or you think you're the doer. When you notice, what is it doing? Look at it, doing, 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 doing. Look at knowing, 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 knowing. What is knowing? Look at these feelings, pain and pleasure, happiness. You notice that all pain is just a gap between two pleasant feelings. And all pleasure is just a gap between two painful feelings. And the amount of pleasure you have now is just dependent upon the pain you had before. That's why when sometimes people like leave the retreat, they feel so happy. All the pain of sitting is gone. Now you're free. Which is why that many people take the photographs at the end of a retreat. No matter what the retreat was like, everyone looks happy at the end of a retreat. Does that mean they've all enlightened and they enjoyed the retreat? No, because they're looking forward to going home. That's why they're smiling. So when you look at pain, it's just pain, pleasure, it comes and goes. And you can't expect to have always pleasure, 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 pleasure. You'll have pain, pain, pain as well. And see the mind when you see nimittas. See it again and again and again, and you realize it's fragmentary. There's no knower behind this process. There's no soul, no self. And you see the doer, the last of the Satipatthanas. What is doing all of this? Who decided to come here? Who decides to scratch their leg? Who decides to move their body? Where did that come from? Why did you speak? When you actually start investigating that, it's fascinating. You see the driverless seat of your bus. No one is there, fully conditioned. So you really unravel non-self. That is the whole purpose of the Four Satipatthanas. To see this just body, just feelings, just mind objects, nothing more than that. Not a self or a soul there. That's the purpose. Once you understand the purpose of Satipatthana, you understand what it's really there for. To get enough insight to see through the illusion of self. Next question. Does every intentional karma make an imprint onto our mind stream, being a stronger karma making a stronger imprint, thus causing the cause and effect to be equally strong when we receive it later? It doesn't really make an imprint on our mind stream. It's not as if like the mind stream is stamped and contains all the information from the past. It's much better to look at the workings of karma in the same way that you have memory. Your memory is not stored in any part of your body or any part of your brain. The memory is the ability of the mind to connect with the past events. Especially those of you who have experimented with these early life memories. Those aren't contained in any part of your body. Sometimes you'll be surprised, you'll get a past life memory. How can you get a memory of a past life? Where can that be stored in your body? Because you've got a completely new body. All the genes are completely different. All the atoms are different. How can that information be carried across the space called death? And after a while you realize this way this memory works is literally you are connecting with the past. Nothing is being stored. You're actually literally going back into the past, connecting with it, resonating with it, and getting those memories. The memory is so similar to the way that karma works. Just like an event now can jog your memory, and you can actually resonate with the past, and you remember that past event, because it's similar to something happening now. In the same way, you might be in a state of mind which is similar to an old state of mind many years ago, many lifetimes ago, and then you connect with that karma, and that karma can come to fruition. Which is why if you become a stream winner, you can never resonate with many, many bad karmas. Many of those bad karmas are cut off from you forever. You don't have to pay off the debts when you become a stream winner. The way that karma works, you're in certain situations, and that literally makes a connection with a long time in the past, and the karma from the past can then flow to you. It's like a bank account in Zurich. You're not in Zurich, you're in Ipoh. But every now and again, you get on the internet and there's a channel, and you can draw money from that account. This is what happens with karma. Very close to memory. It doesn't make imprints on the mind stream. It's imprints in time which you connect. Director, last night you mentioned that a test for an arahat is the absence of desires and having few emotional, national possessions, material possessions. Isn't it a matter of not being attached to the things rather than having the things? Please comment. Aha, great question. If you're not attached to those things, you don't have them. If I'm not attached to my backpack, the backpack falls off and separates itself from me. Attachments are what tie these things to you. That's why they're called possessions. I mention that because people say, oh yeah, I've got a car, but I'm not attached to it. Yeah, I've got a lover, but I'm not attached to them. I have sex, but I'm not attached to it. I just watch the feelings rise and pass away. They say, you know, I have all this money, but I'm not attached to it. I have my Rolex watch, but I'm not attached to it. And that is all wishful thinking. If you have those, if you're not attached to it, why don't you just give it away straight away? Why don't you give your Rolex watch to some charity and auction it off so they can go to like an old person's home or to an orphanage or somewhere where we can do a much better job? What do you need a Rolex watch for? Just get a simple one. So a lot of times all these possessions we have, we say that we're not attached, but we are attached to them. So if you aren't attached, you'll let them go. Are you attached to your thoughts? If you weren't attached to your thoughts, they would just disappear. And you'd be so still and peaceful. Isn't that what you want in this meditation? Just be peaceful and silent and still. So all of you are having trouble letting go of your thoughts. Now you know you're attached to them. This is actually where you find out, when you try and let go of them. The test of attachment is when things are taken away from you. Those of you who came in a car here, if you go out there tomorrow morning and you find that someone's stolen your car, then you find out if you're attached to it or not. Ah! And as I said, you find out if you're attached to your husband, to your wife, when you go home tomorrow and they find they've run away with your best friend. You find out if you're attached to your possessions, if the burglars have been into your home and they've stolen everything. So many people think, I'm not attached, they're just possessions. I just have them here, it's not attached. Yeah, it's just wishful thinking, you are. And you find out when someone steals them. So it's a great question, because too many people, even some monks I know, sometimes they say, oh yeah, we're not attached. We just got these possessions just because they're there, we're not really attached to them. A lot of times if you, what have you got them for? Then you probably see that when I travel, I just got my bowl and my little bag. I travel lightly. I don't have checking baggage unless I'm carrying something from Perth to the Buddhist Gem Fellowship or to the people in Ipoh. I'm a courier sometimes of Dharma books, but I don't have any much possessions myself. You can see just the way I travel. It's much easier when you have a few possessions. You just go straight in on the aircraft, you come straight out again, you don't have to wait by those carousels. It's very easy to check you through customs. And it makes a lot of sense to travel light. What do you need all this stuff for? When you're traveling, you don't need like a spare robe. You know, it's not like you have a different dress. I wear my morning robe, and then my robe for the afternoon, and my special evening robe to look good. So it's great when you have a few possessions. Life becomes so much easier. So I can't see why a person, especially a monk, would be going around with many suitcases and lots of luggage. What are they doing that for? It's just a burden, just a pain. So if you're not attached to these things, quite naturally, because they're just burdensome, you just let them go and give them away. It's a good question, because sometimes people say, oh yeah, I can have these things, but I'm not really attached. If you're not really attached, give them away. Prove it. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it true that keeping the 8 precepts will aid in enhancing better meditations compared to holding only 5 precepts? Usually it does. As long as you're healthy enough to keep that 6 precepts of not eating in the afternoon, because those precepts are rules of renunciation. Even more important than the 6 precepts is like the change in the 3rd precept from no sexual misconduct to no sex at all, because when you don't have no distractions, you become very, very pure and very peaceful, and that's easy to meditate then. But also the seventh precept, you're not looking at entertainment, you're not sort of putting on makeup. So, you know, you're not putting on deodorant if you're a man. You know, just as you are, as you smell, that's how people notice you. So you're giving them the teaching, this is the reality of my body. It stinks, yeah, so does yours. So, this is life. Now you know about attachment to bodies. So please don't be attached to mine, and I won't be attached to yours, stinky. So it does actually help come closer to the truth and get much better insight into people. You know that I often do marriage ceremonies, and some of the disciples, they get married, they want a religious blessing. I don't know what the marriage ceremony is like here in Malaysia, but we always actually make holy water. It's maybe a Thai tradition. You sprinkle, you know, the happy couple with holy water. However, when I do it, I sprinkle, especially the bride, with heaps of holy water until all the makeup starts running. And I tell the groom, see, this is who you're marrying. When you get all this paint off, that's what she really looks like. Do you want to go ahead? I'm really mean. But they found it fun. So all this makeup is just a lie. It's just deceiving. So that way, that's sort of we're truthful. And so if you keep truthfulness, no distractions, peacefulness, of course that's going to enhance your meditation. So that's why eight precepts are there for just peacefulness, truthfulness, and simplicity. Durajan, can you please explain to us the significance of the relics? Okay, I don't know which relic you mean. I know I'm 53 years old, so I'm getting close to being a relic. At least my young supporters say I am. But the real relics, they're supposed to be bones of the Buddha or the great enlightened ones. And it's one of those little amazing little things that sometimes people have got little faith that is too scientific, and because they are too scientific, they get too skeptical. And so sometimes relics are a great thing for skeptics, because it just happens really naturally. This is one of the easiest to see of the psychic or supernatural events. You get like one or two relics, you put them in a little container, and if you're a Buddhist in your house, you can put them in your house even, but you've got to be a good Buddhist, you know, doing some sort of ceremonies, worshipping or meditating, keeping precepts. And if you actually pay respect for those relics every day and you keep your precepts and you meditate, you find that those relics increase in number. And the receptacle is closed, it's glued together. There's no way anyone could have put anything in there. You find they increase. And it's marvelous. And it is a supernatural event which you've witnessed. It's not that, it's very common. Sometimes, though, you have your relics in your little container and you find they disappear. And if they do, you have to be very worried. You've been naughty. There's something you haven't done. Because it's true, if you're not a good person, the relics just vanish. That happened in the Buddhist Society of Victoria in Melbourne. Somebody gave some relics of the Buddha to the president of that Buddhist society, who was a lecturer at the university. He was one of these theoretical Buddhists who read the suttas but never practiced, never kept the five precepts. You may have met people like that. They know a lot, but they do hardly anything at all. All theory. And so when he got these relics, these are relics, superstitious stuff. I'm not into that, I'm into Abhidharma. So he put the relics in the cupboard in his home and forgot about them. Only a year later he remembered he promised to take them to the temple, so he opened the cupboard and took them out and they'd vanished. No relics left, just the empty container. And that's when he got his faith. My goodness, something's happened. It couldn't have disappeared, but it had. And he realized that, yeah, if you don't look after those things, they disappear. So relics are very, very fascinating and powerful. However, there's heaps of relics. If you actually gather together all the relics of the Buddha in the temples, in the shrines today, and put them in a big heap, they'd be 100 times bigger than the the size of the Buddha when he was alive. So you think, where did all those relics come from? Are they real Buddha relics or what are they? And now we come to the story, there's two types of relics. They're both equally powerful, they're both Buddha relics. One actually do come from his original bones. One, the other one, comes from faith. And this beautiful story, which apparently was true, so I was told, is from Tibetan Buddhism. If you haven't heard this one before, it's a great story. Before the communist invasion, there was a lady in Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, devoted Buddhist. Always, you know, looking after the monks, going to listen to talks, studying, chanting. And her son was a trader. He would buy goods in Tibet, take them in a sort of a, not a camel train, this yak train, over the passes in the Himalayas, sell them in India, buy Indian goods, import them into Tibet, and then sell them. The classic import-export business. And, you know, he did quite well in his business, and one day his mother said, look, you go to India, that's the place where the Buddha lived. There are many old temples there, and there'd probably be lots of relics of the Buddha. Next time you're in India, can you see if you can get me a relic of the Lord Buddha so I can put in my shrine? Now the son, you know, he wasn't really into relics or Buddhism, he was just a merchant, a businessman, but it was his mother. So he said, yes, mother, I'll certainly get you one. And he really intended to do that. Because there's many places you could get a relic of the Buddha. They'd give a temple a bit of money and they would probably sell him a relic or two. So he really determined he would do that. But like many sons doing business takes up so much time that he forgot. He was actually travelling over the passes when he first saw the city. He remembered, oh my goodness, I forgot. I didn't get my mum her relic. So when he went home, his mother said, you got a relic, son? He said, no, look, I'm sorry, mum, I forgot. You know, business was so difficult. You know, the economy is never any good. Every time I come to Malaysia, the economy is not very good. Even when it's booming, it's not very good. And he said, well, I'll get it next time. A couple of months, I'll go back again. So he travelled to India the next time. Same thing happened. He forgot. He said, oh, I'm sorry, mum. Next time, absolutely, I won't let you down a third time. So the third time he went to India, it was a very, very difficult trading and buying and selling. And it wasn't when he was on the pass again, he saw Lhasa, he remembered, oh my goodness, I've forgotten a third time. I can't go back empty-handed to my mother a third time. What am I going to do? I just can't say I haven't got one. So he used a little bit of lateral thinking. He looked to the side of the pass, and sure enough, there's many like dead animals who fell over the precipice. And he saw a dead dog which had fallen over and had been, you know, eaten by the crows or the vultures. And there's just a few old dead dog bones there. So he said, a dog bone, a Buddha bone, who knows? Now my mother's not a biologist or not a doctor, she won't know the difference. So he climbed down and got a tiny bit of the dog bone. And just to make it look like a relic, he got this very expensive piece of satin cloth he got in India and wrapped it up really nicely. You know, a lot of people just believe in the wrapping. If it comes in an expensive packet, it must be something expensive inside. So he wrapped it up really nicely. And when he got home, his mother said, you haven't forgotten again, have you, son? And a big smile said, no, mum, I've got your relic. And he gave his mother this dog bone wrapped in silk. And his mother was overjoyed. She started crying, a relic of the Buddha, a relic of the Buddha, sadhu, sadhu. And she was so excited, she put it right in the shrine in the middle. And he left, oh, the silly old woman, he thought, my mother. And he doesn't even know the difference between a dog bone and a Buddha relic. But she's satisfied, and I've got out of my trouble. So he went off to go and sell his goods, but he got in India. 2 days later, when he came back to his house, there's this huge crowd of people outside his house. What's going on? Has someone died? Is my mother sick? And the people said, no, it's a miracle. Amazing things are happening. He said, well, that's my mother's house. What's happening? So he pushed his way inside. And when he tried to get in the room, it was full of monks. He said, "Now, give me way. This is my house. It's my mother." It's only because he was a son he could get into the house. "What are you all doing?" And the monk says, "It's a miracle. It's a miracle." And so he forced his way into the room, the shrine room. And there was his mother with all these incredible senior lamas worshipping. Because this dog bone was now this beautiful white crystal sending out these rays of light. And everybody could see the radiance coming from this. Was it a dog bone? Or was it a Buddha relic? You make up your mind. Did faith, trust, transform that bone into something different? Or was it really a dog bone? But it was there, radiating. The power of faith is so strong. But what actually happens, the reason why relics increase or disappear, because the heavenly beings, the devas, if you're not looking after your relics, they take them away and put them in somebody else's relic chamber where they know it's going to be worshipped. If a woman like that has so much faith, those devas will take away that dog bone and replace it with a real Buddha relic, a powerful one, which is what they did. Now that's what happens with relics. Incredibly interesting and sometimes very powerful. It's the Buddha relics, the great fun. Dear Ajahn Brahm, was the Bodhisattva stream enterer or anagami before the Bodhisattva's full enlightenment when he took his last rebirth? Okay, no one really knows, but in the Pali tradition, it's only called the Bodhisattva from the time when he got up into the Tusita realm throughout the whole life in the Tusita realm to the time he got reborn into this realm. That's the only time they call him Bodhisattva. In previous lives, they never called a Bodhisattva. So a Bodhisattva in the Pali tradition is not a being who's going to eventually become enlightened. It's a being who's that close to enlightenment, that close to being a Buddha. And as far as my understanding is, this is goes not what the suttas say, but what the suttas infer, and many monks, senior monks, really get upset when I say this, but I reckon there's lots of evidence that the Buddha was a once-returner when he got reborn in this last life. When he left his mother's womb, when he walked those seven steps and said, "This is my final life," the only way he could be able to say that was if he'd have known he was a once-returner. If he was an anagami, a non-returner, you'd never get reborn into this human realm. You get reborn into the deva realms called the pure abodes. So, once returner, was the Buddha. Got that attainment under Kassapa. If the mind is of no gender, then how does our past karma determine of what sex we will be born into our next lives? Okay, just like you can wear the clothes of a man or of a girl, you can wear the clothes of a prince or a pauper, you can wear the clothes of a monk or like a yogi. These are just the clothes which the mind wears. And if it inclines to the female gender, then that you get reborn as a woman. If it inclines to the male gender, you get reborn as a man. A lot of times, you may see like men who are very effeminate. They're not always gay just because they're effeminate. It means in their past life they've been a woman. And they've taken some of those characteristics from their past life. Sure, they're male and they're heterosexual, but they've got many female characteristics because of their past life. There are some women, we call them tomboys. They're very masculine in their sort of character. But you know, they are also, they've got husbands, but because of their past life, they've got many male characteristics. And so you can actually see that in amongst your friends. You know, that how there's a change from life to life, and how you take some of the old characteristics with you. You know, that's what happens, but you do change. So if you've been a man in your past life, you know, you'd be more, you know, that male characteristics would be very pronounced if you're female in your last life, the female characteristics will be very pronounced. But if you keep changing, then you know, your characteristics, there's a lot of feminine in you if you're a man, a lot of male in you if you're a female. And that explains a lot. It explains why now there are such things as gays or lesbians. Simply because in the past life they've been very strong females, say, and now they've been born as a male, but they still sort of associate the inclination by looking for a male partner, or the opposite way with a female partner. There's so much past karma and past lives involved with this. And that's why that, you know, if there is any gays and lesbians, you think a lot of acceptance, because nothing they can do, it's not an evil thing, or nothing they can choose. So you accept them as long as they keep precepts. Good on them. Yeah? Sorry, Travis? So when to go for a sex change, in most cases you'd say, look, make peace with who you are, and just allow that, your present body, to be good enough for you. So in other words, whatever you have to deal with in life, you know, don't try and think that if you actually make an operation that somehow all the problems will be changed. They don't get changed. However, that some people are just so, say, there may be men, they may so associate with being a woman, that sometimes a sex change gives them happiness and gives them a sense of peace. That's who they always thought they were. The same with a woman, you know, might want to be a man. That's who they think they really were. And it's only extreme cases. In extreme cases, okay. Yes? What determines which country a person's born in? So a lot of times, again, your inclination, your desires. What actually determines your rebirth are two things, the karma and also your desire, your craving. So, for example, why would you go to, say, Australia? You have to want to get there, but you also have to have the means to get there, the money, the air ticket. If you want to get there, but you've got no ticket, you can't reach the destination. If you have the ticket, but you don't really want to go there, again, you won't get on the plane. You have to have the means and the will. So this is actually what determines our future birth. Where we want to be reborn, and also whether we have the means to be reborn there. The good enough karma. So I know that when I was a young monk in Thailand, some people said, oh, it's so poor in Northeast Thailand, eating frog on rice, I would have been reborn in the West. And so because of their good karma, because of aspiration, they go and get reborn in the West. So, you know, like, remember where sort of goodness, happiness is. Sometimes it's not good to be born in the wealthiest country, just a medium country, because the wealthiest country usually has lots of enemies. They have to fight all the wars. It's much better to be a middle country. You know, not too big, not too small, not too rich, not too powerful, but not sort of powerless either, not like in Africa. So Malaysia is one of these lovely little countries in the middle. So no one is really going to go to war with it. And so, you know, it doesn't have to send troops, so it doesn't have to prove anything. So because of that, you know, you're in a pretty good, you made a pretty good choice. So that's actually what determines. And with the sex and like next life, what you want to be. Like some people, like some men look at women and say, oh, it's so wonderful to be a woman. And if they think like that, they become a woman. Some women say, oh, I wish I was a man in the next life and I could become a monk or whatever. You have that wish to become a man. But the point is, you don't need to be anyone other than you are. Can you please explain the four types of enlightened beings, namely stream winner, once returner, non returner, arahat? I did that last night. Was somebody sleeping last night? That's the stream winner is the one who's on the path, who's seen the Dhamma, seven more lifetimes to become fully enlightened. The once returner is like the simile of the shipwrecked sailors. They're on the way to Nibbana. They've seen where it is. They understand what it's all about. They're practicing. They're halfway there. The non-returner is so close to enlightenment that they won't come back to this realm ever again. It's when they die, they get reborn in the pure abodes, and they'll get Nibbana there, parinibbana there. And the arahant is already fully enlightened in this very life. They're fully enlightened. They'll teach, they'll be kind, and when they die, they just disappear forever. Dear Ajahn, a Buddhist friend of mine has a husband who is suffering from cancer and has spent huge sums of money in the treatment. Her husband still suffers immense pain and will doze off when he meditates. When the doctor told her that her husband is now suffering from an autoimmune disease, she is totally shattered and now experiencing depression to the extent of almost committing suicide. At the moment, she is undergoing psychiatric care and taking depression medication. How can we help her to overcome this ordeal? Please advise. Thank you, Ajahn. Sometimes when people get into that state, it's a bit late. Really, they should have been listening to Dhamma, understanding truth a lot earlier in their life. And they understand that all of this mind, beloved and pleasing, will one day be taken away from us. That we will all either get cancer or get heart attacks, we'll die somehow or other. So we should accept the fact that each one of us is going to pass away, that our loved ones are going to die. We should never be shattered by the obvious news that now people are dying. Which is why if I drop dead in the next half an hour, you should never be surprised. You have to be expected. I can die at any time, so can each one of you. So why are people surprised when they get this news? Your father suddenly got cancer and dropped dead. You should say, I expected that. We expect people to die any time. As soon as we can understand the truth of life, that we're only in this place for a short while, we can die any time. So understanding that every moment is important, we don't take anybody or anything for granted. Every moment is a gift, which is why it's called a present moment. Understanding that when somebody has cancer, we try our very best to look after them. But if nothing is working, we let them go. We allow them to die. It's not working. We have to make that decision, which is important. If we give all of our money to trying to keep a person alive when it's hopeless, we are being cruel and uncompassionate to our children, other people who could make better use of that money. We've got to be wisely compassionate. It's not being cold, it's being wisely compassionate. And there comes a time when we say, look, it's a hopeless task. I have to let you go. And if a person is wise, they're happy to let go. They know if they've lived a good life, they've done lots of good karma, they'll always go to a good rebirth. So keeping this old body going, you're stopping them, you're delaying them, enjoying their nice holiday in heaven. Now if you were going to go on this wonderful holiday, this beautiful heaven realm, and I delayed you, say, no, don't go yet. Go next week. Say, no, I want to go now. No, I'll pay you thousands and thousands of dollars to the doctors so you don't go on this wonderful holiday until a year's time. That's stupid. I want to go now. So if you're going to go to some heaven realm, isn't it sooner the better? So let people go for goodness sake. And, if why we get depressed is because life does not go according to our expectations. And we get frustrated with life. And it's really not really understanding what life is all about. If we truly understood what life was, we'd never really get depressed. It's just what happens in life, that's all. So please understand what life can give you. It can only give you so much. If you ask for more, you will suffer. If Sakyamuni Buddha could not even recognize, more so appreciate the fully enlightened being in Buddha Kassapa, how and what evidence is there to show that Bodhisattva then had practiced the paramis? Great question. There's not much evidence, is there? Is the parami thing a later addition to the original Buddhist text? Yes, it was. The original Buddhist text had nothing about paramis. Is it necessary and a prerequisite for one to practice the paramis before becoming fully enlightened? It wasn't necessary for the Buddha. So why should it be necessary for you? It was a later edition. Quite a lot later edition, not in the original Buddhist teachings. And then it's interesting that the Mahayana started the parami business with the six paramitas. And the Theravada afterwards, just to keep up with the Joneses, they had 10 paramitas. Just, we got more paramitas than you have. So it was a much dated edition. How does a meditator know he or she is a once-returner, non-returner, or whatsoever? It's very difficult for you to know whether you're a stream winner, once-returner, or fully enlightened. However, it's very easy for you to know that you are not a stream winner, or that you're not fully enlightened. So the point being here, you can usually see, you get angry, you know, you're irritated, you get upset, you get sad, you grieve when your loved one gets cancer or is dying. You say, put my hand out, I'm not fully enlightened yet. So you can know you're not enlightened, but just because you haven't got grief, you haven't got anger, you're very peaceful, you're simple living, it doesn't mean you're fully enlightened. All it can mean is those hindrances are suppressed for a while. So you really have to have the test of time. You see that all those hindrances, all those cravings, those attachments have disappeared for a long period of time. Then, you know, looks like it's full enlightenment. You have to test yourself out for a long time, first of all. Is there any proven record of the above states? Yeah, sure there is. It's the Buddha, people like Ajahn Chah, people getting these amazing states. And it's true, you see them never getting angry. No lust at all, nothing at all. We are always advised to check with the Buddha's original teachings. The teachings were only written down about 100 BC, i.e. about 400 years after the Buddha's parinirvana. So wasn't there a certain degree of adulteration by then? Yes, there was. So what you can do, it's well known in the Buddha's history, that like Buddhism diverged around about 150 to 200 years after the parinirvana of the Buddha. That's when it started splitting up into different sects. Interesting, what they disagreed with was mostly on points of Abhidhamma. It's all the thinking monks, the scholar monks, they did all the arguing. The meditating monks, they're always friendly to always each other. And you guys are arguing over stupid things. No reason to have different sects. But because they had different sects, they split up. Each one had their own suttas, their own Vinaya. And what people have done quite reasonably, they're saying, well, what we have in common must have been the core. And what's been added must have been what's different was what everybody added. So you've got, this example, Theravada and Mahayana. Theravada would have added something. You can't see that in the Mahayana Agamas. What's in the Mahayana Agamas, which is not in the Theravada, the Mahayana must have added. Because it's very unlikely they added the same. And because of that, you can actually, by comparing all the suttas in the Chinese tradition and all the suttas in the Pali tradition, you can actually start to see by comparing what is common is probably Buddhism of about 100 years after the parinirvana of the Buddha, at the very least. So you're getting very close. And interesting, for those people who know the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Pali, the Theravada Satipatthana, they have added onto the fourth Satipatthana. The original Satipatthana Sutta in the Chinese Agamas, in all those mind objects which you now see in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, a lot of those have been added much later. The original ones were just the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. That's the oldest version of the Satipatthana Sutta. The fourth Satipatthana, the Dhammanusati, that used to originally just be the reflecting on the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. Now you see all these six sense bases, four noble truths. All that has come afterwards. Not that it's wrong, but it's not original. So this is an example of how, by comparing, you can actually find out and take that investigation to Buddhism about 100 years after the time of the parinirvana of the Buddha. And there you can find the core teachings. And that's work underway at the moment. You find out the Pali Canon, the Sutta Pitaka, is very accurate. There's only little bits here and there which has been added. But sure, they have been added. And I keep on saying, the Abhidharma certainly has been added. There's no doubt about that. Dear Ajahn, if A hurts B and in due time B hurts A back, does B's action create further bad karma so that A strikes back at another time? Does the law of karma work this way? Thanks. If A hurts B, then A creates bad karma. Not B. If B hurts A back, then B has created bad karma. So you can't blame other people. You didn't have to take revenge. You can always forgive. So once forgiveness happens, you say, you've hurt me. I should hurt you back, but I won't. I forgive you. I let it go. Then the whole cycle is broken. So that's why it doesn't matter who has misbehaved, who is in the wrong. If you try and take revenge back, either physical revenge, or you break off with them, or you don't speak to them, then you are perpetrating the endless cycle. You are keeping it going. As soon as you say, I forgive you, never mind. No, I'm not going to hurt you back. The door of my heart's open to you. No matter what you've done to me, I forgive you completely. Then someone's done harm to you, but you don't do harm back. That way you never make bad karma, you make beautiful, good karma, the karma of forgiveness. And that way all these cycles of enmity get broken, once and for all. So that's what we should do. Anger never is solved with more anger, it's only solved with forgiveness. Solution to many of life's problems. The Raja, may I ask, have qualities of monks and monkhood gone down compared to the time of the Buddha? Is forest tradition the standard practice of Sangha? And today was enjoy jokes as well. Today was take shit in terms of the tech monks. I was told it was a Hindu god who encouraged Buddha to teach, or is it the Anagami? Since young, I always have a mental image like a ruby fire chest when I sleep. Is it due to previous life? But it's different from the blue nimitta. Why? Once when I woke up in the middle of the night, I saw myself standing in front of my bed for quite a while. Please explain. How do we know which are good and bad ghosts? Thanks. Please, one question each is enough. May I ask, have qualities of monkhood gone down compared to the times of the Buddha? They go up and they go down. I think Ajahn Chah said, it's like a tree. When a tree is young, it's fit and healthy, full of life. The longer it lasts, it gets decayed, and the branches start falling off, and it's a dead old tree. And it's always the case in Buddhism, you get many dead trees, but all those dead trees and rotten branches, like monks or nuns are not really practicing, before they got to that state, they all had their fruit, and that fruit has made other trees, young saplings, which are full of life and purity. Now it's always the case in the Sangha. So like, I look at my monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth, that's a young, nice, good tree, it's gone up from a sapling to a really powerful tree, it's a great monastery, but I know the future of that monastery is going to become decadent. It's going to decay. I don't know how long you try and keep off the decay as long as possible. It's going to become just another monastery of ceremonies, monks being lazy, not keeping the precepts, not meditating, because that's just what happens. It's just a decay. But in that time, I hope we had many good monks who have gone through that monastery. They start their own monasteries and other beautiful, strong, good monasteries coming up. So this is actually the nature of life. When someone is young, little baby, they grow and then they get into this maturity. They're full of energy and full of life. And then in their old age, they get bent over, rotting teeth, wrinkled skin, grey hair, they get old and decrepit. And then they die, just like a monastery does the same. But the point is that in that time, they've had many children, and they take on the burden of spreading the Dhamma. So, the point is that the qualities of monks, monkhood, monasteries, they go up, they go down. There's always resurgence of purity. At the same time, you always feel alongside decadence. And that's the nature. It's always been that way, always will be that way. So you choose the good monks, the good nuns. And you be a good layperson, not a decadent one. And the day was enjoy jokes as well. The day was take turns. They was enjoy happiness. So they do enjoy jokes, probably more than we do. And that's one of their problems. They should actually be a bit more serious sometimes. And do they take turns shift to protect monks? A lot of times the day was looking after themselves, but sometimes they come down to protect you. I was told it was a Hindu god who encouraged Buddha to teach. No, it was the Anagami, Brahma Sahampati. It wasn't a Hindu god. At the time of Buddhism, there was no Hinduism. It was the Vedic Brahmanism, very different than the Hinduism today. Anyone who says that Buddhism was an offshoot of Hinduism doesn't know history. At that particular time, what the religion which was around in the Buddha's time was very, very, very different than the Hinduism we know today. It was all sacrifice, ceremonies, nothing which is meditative or spiritual at all. And so it was an anagami, not a Hindu god. In Sikshang, I always have a mental image like a ruby fire chest when I sleep. Is it due to previous life? It could be, but it doesn't really matter. It's different from the blue nimitta because it's only when you're sleeping. You haven't really developed the mind yet. If you develop the mind, you get much better nimittas. He woke up in the middle of the night and saw myself standing in front of my bed for quite a while. I just had an out-of-body experience. It's nothing much. You just go back again. No big deal. And how do we know which are the good and bad ghosts? Okay. The good... Actually, all ghosts are a bit stupid. It's not like... Is there a good yogi or a bad yogi here? No, none of you are all good. None of you are all bad. And just like ghosts have their bad days and have their good days. Sometimes they're naughty. And sometimes they behave themselves. It's just ghosts being ghosts. Are there such a thing as good husbands and bad husbands? Or are they just husbands, that's all? Just being husbands. Is there such a thing as a good wife or a bad wife? Is there such a thing as a good son or a bad son? Or are they just, you know, pretty much all the same? A few little variations. That's like ghosts. The ghosts are just ghosts, that's all. They're just ghost nature. Okay. Please excuse me if we carry on with these questions, because I should finish them, even though it's cutting in the interview time, simply because that these questions, last opportunity to answer these questions, and answer our one question, everyone hears it. In the interview, it's only one-on-one, so it actually doesn't spread the Dharma so far. So please excuse if it cuts off on the interview time. Dear Ajahn, what is right effort if we are not supposed to try it on meditation? It's the effort to nurture. It's the effort of a gardener. And the gardener never tries to pull the tree up to make it grow faster. Otherwise, it's a really bad gardener. The gardener nurtures a tree, protects it, safeguards it. And that's your effort in meditation, to protect and guard the mind. So you don't do anything, you stop interfering. It's the effort which gives rise to wholesome states. And that effort is letting go. Dear Ajahn, since you have been there in jhana, seen an emptiness and done it, got enlightened, can we assume that you are an arahant? You don't have to answer, okay, I won't. Dear Ajahn, all things being equal, is it easier to attain enlightenment if one is a monk or a nun? Absolutely equal. So it doesn't matter, monk or a nun. Dear Ajahn, why there's no compilation of Buddhist sutras like a Bible of Christian to unify the teaching? Too many books and don't know which to study. What do you recommend? How many Bibles are there? There's heaps of them. Every sect has got its own Bible. You look at the Catholic Bible, the Anglican Bible, they are different. They've got different texts, different translations. Even in Christianity they can't agree. There is no single Bible in Christianity. Every Christian knows that, if they actually are honest. And it's the same in Buddhism, that we do have many, many sutras, we have many things in common, but, you know, added a bit here, added a bit there. And I say, what's been added is not wrong, most of it, it's just extra. So, you know, it's not really necessary. To unify the teachings, there's enough in Buddhism which we all have in common, and what we all have in common, the unifying factor of the teachings is the Eightfold Path. That's why I mentioned that, I think, last night, where the Buddha said, any religion, practice, sect of Buddhism or of any other religion which has the Eightfold Path will always have enlightened beings. Simply because that's the cause for enlightenment to happen. Eightfold Path. So that's what we have in common. Yeah. Doesn't matter whether it's the ultimate goal or not the ultimate goal. Doesn't matter what you're trying to get. If you do the Eightfold Path, it happens even if you don't want it to happen. If you don't expect it to happen. So, it just happens. If you put the cause in effect, it happens. For example, if you live the human life, you're going to die, whether you want it or not. It just happens. And the death happens. That's the one thing you'd be sure of. So if you do the Eightfold Path, you know Nibbana is going to happen, whether you like it or not. Sometimes people don't want it to happen. I don't want to leave samsara. Yeah, I want my attachments. Like many of my monks, I don't know if I told you this, I've got a number of monks who've ordained in the last year or two, and they're very upset they've ordained. They wish they'd have put it off for another year, and then maybe just, you know, the end of this year, so they could have seen the last episode of Star Wars. Now they're monks, they can't see it. I think, oh, why did I wait? Put off my ordination for another 6 months. If I'd have only put off my ordination, I could have seen Star Wars and then become ordained. So sometimes people don't want to become a knight. Yeah. You had a question? Yeah? Yeah, that's the ultimate aim. But as I said last night, you know what enlightenment is? So you're aiming for some place or some destination. You don't know where it is anyway. So you're aiming for something you don't know about. Is that really a good idea? It's like you're going home, but you're not quite sure where that home is. And they wander here and wander there, wander all over the place. So don't aim for enlightenment, because you don't know where that is. Aim for peace. You know what peace is? Aim for stillness. Yeah, I can understand what stillness is. Aim for freedom, freedom from desires. I can understand that. And as you aim for those things, which make a lot of sense, then you get closer and closer to Nibbana. You get close enough to the stream when you can see, ah, I know what Nibbana is now. Yeah, I'll go for that. Yeah? Go on. Is it easier to attain enlightenment as a Sangha person? Generally speaking, yes. In the same way, it's easier to get a degree if you go to university, because that's what's what the universities are there for, to make it easy getting a degree. But you can get a degree by post, or you do distant learning, whatever it's called, correspondence course. It's much easier if you're actually in the university, you get all the lectures, all the resources, everything is there for you. So that's why it is easier to gain enlightenment as a monk or a nun, but it's not essential. The same way, you know, you can actually get to KL by walking. Well, it's not recommended. You get a bus, a car, an aircraft, it's much better. So you've got all those wonderful vehicles there, so why not take them? So if you want to become enlightened, sure you can walk there. You know, be a lay person, but if you really want to go for it, then become a monk or a nun. You've got this, you know, super jet called Sangha Airways. Okay. Next question. Is Arahat mindful at all time? Can they lose their memory due to old age? They can lose their memory of the past, of worldly things. They can never forget the Dhamma though. Their mindfulness is, again, mindfulness is always focused on important things. So to be mindful of the breath, you're not mindful of, you know, your feet, say. So, you know, mindfulness is always selective. So the arahat will always be mindful of the Dhamma, but they may be forgetful about things. Dear Ajahn, why is there no... Oh, hang on already. Compilation of the Bible. Oh, hang on, there's another one. Dear Ajahn, please briefly enlighten, what will happen to all beings when the end of the Buddha Dharma era? Do all go to hell or heaven? All beings at the end of the Buddha Dharma, at the end of the time when this Buddhism being taught, you still get to be reborn as human beings. Some go to heaven, some go to ghost realms, animal realms or whatever. But, and then you get reborn again, and another Buddha appears and you start learning again. I'm not sure if I understood that question perfectly, but is that what you meant? What happens when the Buddhas and the Dhamma disappears in the world? Anyway, that's my answer. Now we get the big question. I love this question. When an arahat passes away, where does the consciousness go to? The parinibbana means everything ceases without remainder. No more consciousness. Nothing left. gone to emptiness. Sometimes say, how can that be? How can consciousness with this energy suddenly disappear? If there was something there in the consciousness to begin with, then there could be no enlightenment at all, because consciousness is seen to be empty. It's just a phantasm, just a phantom, just a delusion, an illusion of causes making this appear as something real, like virtual reality, or like the movie, the hero on the screen. There they are, walking with the heroine off into the sunset at the end of the movie. Then they've disappeared. They've gone, because the lights have gone out. It was only a movie anyway. That wonderful movie star you saw in the movie house for the last 2 hours, where have they gone? It was only a light flickering, that's all. So once the light finishes, the characters disappear. You say at the end of the movie, Indiana Jones, where did he go? At the end of the movie, John Wayne, what happened to him? At the end of the movie, sort of, who is this? Those other movie stars. Jennifer Lopez, what did happen to her? So wasn't Jennifer Lopez on the screen. She was in Hollywood somewhere. All you saw on the screen was light, a bundle of light, cause and effects, which you assumed to be a character, and you gave it meaning. When it ceased, that's all. It's gone out. The Buddha's explanation to this question, he said, like a flame of a candle. Does that flame exist? You can see it, it dances, it moves, you can feel its heat. In one sense, yeah, that candle exists. When the candle is snuffed out, where does the candle flame go to? Does the flame go to some ground of all flames, where all flames go after they pass away, there to be happy ever after? Does the flame go east, north, south, west, is what the Buddha asked Vajragota. And Vajragota said, look, when the flame is only a result which is dependent upon three causes, the heat, the wick, and the wax. If any of those causes gets taken away, in other words, the candle, it burns out, there's no more wax left, then the flame is snuffed out. Or if the wick is all used up, then the flame goes out. Or if the wind blows the heat away, then the flame goes out. So the flame, to survive, it needs heat, it needs wick, it needs wax. And when one of those causes ceases, the result, the flame, ceases. It doesn't go anywhere, it just goes out. Or is it empty, causally produced phenomena, and now ceases to be. This consciousness, this dua, where does that come from? What it is a result of craving and karma. When those two causes, craving and karma, we might call three causes, delusion, craving and karma. When any one of those three causes is taken away, no more delusion, no more craving, no more karma, then the result, this mind, this consciousness with this active doing, disappears, it's snuffed out. It doesn't go anywhere. There's nothing there to begin with. Just a result of many causes. That's why to see the emptiness of consciousness now means you can see that consciousness can completely cease without remainder at Parinibbana. Great question. Hopefully you understood the answer. It's dream winning, you'll understand the answer so well. You see the emptiness. Because of emptiness, therefore it can cease. In the same way a modern scientist, can see the emptiness of all this form we call concrete and marble and brass and steel and earth. It's just full of holes, so full of holes there's nothing left. It's complete emptiness, this universe. Therefore you know it can come out of emptiness. You don't need it to be caused by a God. From emptiness comes the emptiness of the planets, the solar system, the cosmos. you know that therefore you can go back to emptiness at the end of the universal cycle. There's nothing here to begin with. There's nothing here now. There'll be nothing in the future. Emptiness. Pure quantum physics. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what are the signs and symptoms of depression? What is the cause? Is lack of interest to live a symptom? What is the difference between depression and dispassion? Can depression lead to dispassion? Thank you. The symptoms of depression. Sometimes depression is lack of energy, lack of mental energy. The mind is no longer strong. So, because it's no longer strong, everything looks grey. Nothing is exciting anymore. Even the food tastes dull. And people just look really uninteresting. And even Ajahn Brahm's jokes are so boring. You think, well, what's the reason to live? Nothing's worth it anymore. You've just got no energy. The opposite of that, when you get superpower mindfulness, everything is beautiful. Even a lump of shit looks so brown and so rich. Wow. Everything looks beautiful when you have superpower mindfulness. So, you understand, one of the ways of getting over depression is actually to develop that superpower mindfulness through meditation. You get this incredible energy. But once you're in depression, you don't like being depressed, you're depressed about being depressed, and it just gets worse. You get into this pit of depression. I don't want to be depressed. Why can't I be like everybody else? I want to do things. I wasn't depressed years ago. Why am I depressed like this now? I don't want to be depressed. And that makes you more depressed. So, first thing, you can be at peace with your depression. Don't make it worse. When you're at peace with depression, you're actually giving energy to the mind. And soon you come out of that depression. However, if people learn that early on in their life, they don't get deep into the pit. When they get deep into the pit, they do need medication. They do need support. They need to be uplifted. When I was in UK the first time visiting my family in November is a very depressing time of the year. And many people in England at that time, my brother was telling me this while he was driving me to my mother's house, he told me that they just discovered a great cure for this seasonal depression which happens around November. The doctors were referring these people to special psychiatrists, and all they did, they dressed all these English men and women, they took off all their suits and their grey ties, they put them in Hawaiian shirts, they put the girls in really loud floral dresses, they made the rooms incredibly light with beautiful wallpaper, lots of colours, lots of exciting music, and the whole senses were bombarded with colour and with brightness, and that cured their depression. Just, you know, being in a grey area with grey people and grey things. You know that joke, I'm thinking, oh, grey tea, I think people do. It is anything just actually made you depressed. That's why when I give a talk, I used to go to church only a few times, and the sermons were so boring, they made you depressed. And the last thing you want to do is to give a boring talk when you're on retreat. The seven factors of enlightenment are this, the eightfold path is this, the four noble truths of suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, and the way to the end of suffering, and this is the way to do it. The four enlightenment factors are this, and this is... Now, I don't know if you've heard talk like that, but that makes you really depressed. No one wants to come back again. So when I give a talk, make it nice and bouncy. Make it bouncy, people don't get depressed about religion. And you make it, even the way I use my voice, I'm modulated, and I bring it up again. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Then you don't get depressed, you're laughing, it makes it fun. So this is actually one way of getting rid of depression. Just, now you can help that way by being stupid sometimes. By making fun. Apparently there was a movie called Pat Adams. And did I know this? Because our Buddhist society, they actually use it as a fundraiser. They hired a cinema, they showed it, and all the money went to the Buddhist society. And apparently it's all about a doctor who all he does is just wear funny costumes and just cheers people up. And it works wonders for people's health. Just being stupid and clowning around and doing weird things. It makes people laugh, and that gets rid of their depression. And much sickness comes from depression. So that's what you can do. Out of compassion for other people, do silly things, do stupid things. Like when you're breathing, if you want to get against depression, breathe backwards. Remember the breathing backwards? Three in breath, three out breath. And then you don't get depressed, it gives you energy. Okay, it's staying around, but it certainly wakes you up. And afterwards you meditate, and it's really easy. Okay? So, thank you for listening, and all those lovely questions. That's a way to go. Thank you. So let's have some interviews. Again, please keep the interviews short, because I've only got 1 hour. If I don't get round to you this time, just keep coming this afternoon.